Good morning. Shalom Aleichem. It's not morning anymore. It's a good nachmittag. Zeit vergrießt, but everyone understood anyway, right? Great. Wer hat mich verstanden? My name is Mary Coral, and it's my honor today to introduce this event. I am the continuing lecturer in Yiddish at UCLA, and it's been really my great pleasure to be teaching Yiddish at UCLA for 15 years. So it's been an amazing experience. Today especially is a wonderful program for me to introduce because of several reasons. One is that I grew up in a Yiddish-speaking home in New York, and the Fall Belts, which is where the Bintel Brief, the original Bintel Brief, was published, was just a daily part of my home life. It came every single day to our family, including another newspaper, which was typical of Yiddish-speaking families. Right? Depending on your leaning, depending on the time of day, depending on whether you wanted the latest news or not. So we've got two Yiddish newspapers, not just one. Today, the Folders is published once a week still, and you can pick up a copy in Yiddish. And it is also in English, as you know, the foreword. So our event this afternoon is co-sponsored by the Center for Jewish Studies, by the Department of Germanic Languages, which is where Yiddish is housed at UCLA, also by the Forward newspaper, and by HarperCollins, one of the publishers of this remarkable book. I also, before I introduce our speaker, I also want to point out that the Center for Jewish Studies, most of you already know this, is an incredibly active center, and there are events happening once or twice a week. Really, it's an extraordinary resource to take advantage of. And in fact, the very next event is happening, I think it's actually our event, on Sunday, which is the Yiddish Institute event happening here, which is a wonderful look at how the iconography of Marc Chagall, that extraordinary artist, has also influenced modern Israeli visual arts. And that will be a multimedia presentation by Professor Annette Anant Gilboa, and I hope you'll be able to come back for that. That's Sunday here at 4 o'clock. And other upcoming events are next Wednesday, HyperCities, Thick Mapping in the Digital Humanities with Todd Pressner, who's the director of the Center for Jewish Studies. For the Good of Tomorrow, Preserve Today on the 20th, with Dr. Piotr, I won't be able to pronounce this right, Chivinsky. And it did happen here, anti-Nazi activism in Los Angeles on November 25th with Carolyn Luce presenting and Laura Rosenzweig. So many, many wonderful things to look forward to. Today, however, I am very, very pleased to introduce poet and artist Rihanna Fink, who studied fine art and graphic design at Cooper Union College in New York, a fellow New Yorker, I think, yes. In 2009, Rihanna attended the Université de la Carmela in Belgium on a Fulbright Fellowship. She's also a recipient of the Six Points Fellowship for Emerging Jewish Artists. Her publications include The Shul Detective, a 2007 graphic blog for Lilith magazine, in which she explored synagogues in New York City, Revelations and the Stupid Creatures, in 2010, in which she collaborated with stuffed animal maker John Murphy on a visual adaptation of The End of Days, and Phèdre, a comic tragedy, a rhyming graphic novel adapted from her own translation of Racine's classic play that was published in 2010. Liana has served as the artist in residence at Camp Rama in New York and worked with poet Mark Rudman and artist Myra Kalman. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Forward, and Tablet, among other publications. And this new, highly acclaimed graphic novel, A Bindelbrief, was published this year. And I just want to say one small thing, which is that for whatever reason, I have not been a big fan of graphic novels and graphic publications, but when we were sent some attachments of this book as an introduction, meaning me and my Yiddish class, as an introduction to this event today, I absolutely fell in love with those two chapters that we got, and I immediately purchased the book, and it's really, really wonderful, and so looking forward to your presentation today.
Thank you so much. Should I do this side check?
Sure, whatever.
I'm gonna show slides for 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll have a conversation. Can everyone hear me?
No.
How about now?
No.
Okay, great. So I think some of you probably read maybe two of the chapters of the book that are in a pamphlet. So I'm not going to reread those, but I'll read another one. And you all know what the Bindelbrief was? I'll run over it in case anyone hasn't heard of it. A Bindelbrief was a Yiddish advice column that ran in the Forward newspaper beginning in 1906. It was the brainchild of the newspaper's founding editor. His name was Abraham Kahan, and he's just this marvelous kind of Ben Franklin of Yiddish America. He was brilliant, and he was really interesting, and he jumped around from personality to personality. He was just this polymath, and he came from Eastern Europe, fired up with socialism, but once he got to America, he realized that he wasn't a socialist the way the party line wanted him to be a socialist. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. He realized that the socialists were all very intellectual, and they were talking about giving the common man a better life, but they were speaking in such a way that the common man couldn't understand. They were speaking in German or Russian, and the common man, who was Jewish from Eastern Europe, spoke Yiddish and hadn't gone to school. And they spoke in they wrote these very complicated, very boring screeds, and their newspapers were very boring. And he wanted to start a newspaper that anyone could read, like someone who'd just gone to school for a few years. So he started The Forward, and as tended to happen back then, politics happened, and the newspaper was kind of wrested from him by policy people, and it became a boring newspaper, so he left in a huff, and he wouldn't come back until he could do whatever he wanted with the newspaper. And what he wanted was to make it very simple and very fun and kind of pulpy and kind of lowbrow. And he did that by instituting the Bindelbrief, which became this runaway success where people with very little education would write these like heart-rending letters about their terrible problems and like write them in this like bright, pulpy, fun way, and other people with heart-rending problems and tough lives would read them and really enjoy them. So I think the first letter that is in my book and that was written to the Bindelbrief is part of the pamphlet. It's about a watch. It's about a woman who's writing to the Forward because she had one possession in the world, and it was this pocket watch. And it was very important to her because whenever her family didn't have work and couldn't afford food, she would pawn the pocket watch, and they'd be able to afford food until her son got a job again, and then they would buy it back. And it disappeared, and she believes her neighbor stole it. And as he was reading this letter, Ibrahim Kahan thought she's just this kind of cranky, crazy woman who's writing to complain about the petty things in her life, like just writing to a newspaper to be kind of bitchy about it. But as he was reading, he realized that she's not this cranky woman. She's actually this very, very sensitive, very sophisticated woman who doesn't want to confront her neighbor because she doesn't want to hurt her feelings. So she's writing into a newspaper instead, and she knows that her neighbor reads the foreword, as a lot of Yiddish-speaking Jews did. So he published it, and it was the first letter in the Bindle brief, which means a bundle of letters. And I'm gonna read you one called A Mad Barber. A Mad Barber. Dear Mr. Editor, if anyone had ever told me that I would someday write to the Bindle brief, I would have laughed at him. Things are going well for me. I have no unfaithful wife. I am not in love yet. I have never done anyone a wrong that would be on my conscience, and yet I come to you for advice. I am a barber and have been practicing the art for 10 years and become quite adept at it. Sounds good, yes? But the following happened. A few weeks ago, on a quiet afternoon, when there were no customers and the boss was out somewhere, I dozed off while reading the Police Gazette. So a note on this. I drew each of the comics in the collection in a slightly different style to kind of imitate the different handwritings and the different personalities of the people writing the letters. And this one I drew in this like very kind of noir American movie style, because this guy is trying so hard to be all American. He's probably been here for like 4 years or something, and yet he's making a point of reading an American newspaper, not a Yiddish newspaper. So he falls asleep, and here's his dream. And I illustrated, I don't really read manga, but what I love about manga, which is Japanese comics, is that a lot of things, but one of them is that they'll illustrate different things that people do in this like really weird way. Like here we draw Z's when someone sleeps, but they'll draw this like bubble coming out of someone's nose, and there's just like a million different weird symbols. So I made up a symbol for the sleep of a barber, which is little hair clippings next to his face. And he dreams that he's flying up in the sky, and he finds this like being with a beard there who's based on Arkham's Mr. Natural, who is based on God. And his God is this like kind of gross Yiddish-speaking God who represents everything he's trying to run away from. And the God speaks to the barber in this kind of exaggerated, annoying Yiddish accent. And he says, "Oi, you viltring me all away with your American scissors." And our guy has this huge pair of scissors, and he's really tortured. Like, I think he wants to trim this guy away, but he also feels terribly guilty about it. And then in the corner, there's a speech bubble of his boss calling him back home, and it says, "Jack," and you can see the Statue of Liberty down there too. And the boss says, "Jack, come down here, come down right now." And he says, "Coming, boss." And the boss says, "Real Americans don't go flying around in the sky, Jack." And he's waving around his scissors, and they're like a noodle. And the boss says, "Something is wrong with my scissors." And we continue with the narrative. "I soon dreamed that a customer entered." And the boss gasps. "The boss and I took our positions near our chairs, and as usual, the customer selected the one manned by my boss." And the customer is George Washington. "As usual, I was a bit insulted as a craftsman and a little vexed over being robbed of the tip." But the boss really can't cut George Washington's hair. "But it happened that the boss was called away in a hurry, and he asked me to tend to the customer. I began to work on him, and he laughed in my face. He grimaced, made faces, stuck out his tongue, and began to yell. And though I didn't understand the language, I felt he was calling me a clumsy barber. My patience finally gave out. And as I held the razor in my hand, don't question a dream, I slit his throat." And this sequence is based on definitely my first nightmare and maybe my first dream that I remember. I had this pair of bendable rubber dolls when I was a little kid, and one of them looked strangely like my mom. And I dreamed that she was life-size, and I was being this horrible little kid to her, and I wouldn't stop being rude to her. And her head fell off, and I had murdered her. And it was just this horrible guilt dream. So I gave this dream to the barber. "What have you done?" says George Washington's head. You klutz." He calls him a klutz because he knows, it's not that he's calling him a clumsy barber, it's that he knows, like, George Washington knows that this guy speaks Yiddish and is not a real American. And that's the thing that really destroys the barber. So naturally, there was screaming and tumult, and I awoke.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's me, but I'm having a very hard time following what you're saying.
Is it that I'm not loud enough?
I don't know whether it's the microphone.
Yeah.
Or you're doing it too fast. Somehow, I have to confess, I cannot follow you.
Okay. I spat three times to banish my dream, but it didn't help. I tried staying home from work for 2 days, but I can't get the thoughts out of my head. Dear editor, it must seem strange or like a story created by a sick imagination, but what I write here is the truth. Since my foolish dream, I cannot rest. I can't forget the scene. I am always lost in thought and obsessed with the dream. When I stand at my chair and have to use my razor, I get a sudden impulse to do what I did in my dream. The greatest temptation I have to withstand is when my razor gets under the chin close to the neck. Oh, then it is terrible. I am afraid I will go mad. I haven't told anyone about this yet because I am ashamed. I beg you to advise me what to do. Shall I give up my job? I am willing to do anything to rid myself of my dilemma and my suffering. I beg you to give me your opinion. Isn't it madness? A mad barber. So here's the answer. Man's thoughts often weave automatically through idea patterns, as they are called in psychological science, and the muscles respond automatically to the ideas. Every man with a healthy will can shake off the unwanted ideas and reflexes they call forth to the muscles. Every man can dream he commits a terrible crime, because in dreams the controllable will is slumbering. The writer of this letter must simply laugh off the dream and drive the whole matter out of his head. But if his nervous system is for some reason weakened, and therefore his control over his willpower is likewise weak, he must consult a doctor, but he himself must be strong and overcome his impulse. And the answers were always very, like, steady and kind of boring, and people are always disappointed about this, but I think the real reason is that Abraham Kahan knew that these people had all the drama inside. They didn't need more drama coming from outside. They just needed a really wise person to listen to them, because they'd all left their home, they'd left their parents, they'd left their rabbis, they'd left their religion, and they just needed someone to represent power for them, and he did. I don't know, maybe y'all should have you guys read this one already? Okay, this was in the... I'll talk a little bit about how I came to write a Vintel brief. I grew up in Jewish towns outside New York City, and I belonged to these really small Jewish, conservative Jewish communities, and I always felt very different from everyone around there. I was like the shy kid, and I liked art, and I kind of equated being Jewish with being part of these very small conservative communities that didn't appreciate crazy weirdos. And I imagined leaving when I was 18 and going to art school and finding my people. And I did. I went to New York and I found my people. kind of, and I when I was a kid, I always drew. Drawing was like my protection against the world around me. Like, I was very shy and I didn't have friends really, but I could draw and just escape into drawing, and I was good at it, and it was my identity. And people weren't really my friends, and they didn't really get me, but they respected me because I was able to draw. And when I got to art school, I realized that being an artist it was a time when drawing wasn't really a thing that you would do if you went to art school. You're supposed to do maybe performances or videos or something. And I realized that this wasn't really my talent, and I was looking around for something that would be, that would suit more. Like, I had such a long time to incubate my imaginary world that I should belong to, that like it wasn't flexible anymore. I was imagining this place where I could draw and where I'd be accepted for drawing and find other people who could draw. So I decided to kind of create that place. I didn't think it, when I went to art school and didn't find drawing people there, I decided that this place didn't exist and I'd have to create it. And the way I would create it is that I would pretend to be a comics artist, because comics artists are people who draw. And I would make something that wasn't quite a comic, but when I made it, people would know what it was. And everything would be good. So I got this grant to go to Belgium and make a comic. And I was just planning to make this opus. And it was just gonna contain like everything, and it wasn't gonna be little boxes, because I hadn't been raised with comics, and I don't know. And I'm getting shy, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. So anyway, I failed at making my big opus and recreating comics as this highbrow art form. And I was about to go home in terrible shame and get a job. And my last ditch effort to like continue and maybe make another try at making my opus was to apply for another grant. And I looked for, I'm so sorry, I don't know if this story made sense at one point. I found a Jewish grant that I could apply to, so I was like being phony on so many counts. I was pretending to be a comics artist, and then I was gonna pretend that I believed in that I really related to being Jewish, and I was gonna applying for a grant to make this like nice Jewish comic book that a nice Jewish girl would make. And I didn't have a subject for it, so I asked my parents, and they told me about a Bindle Brief, and I'd never heard about it before. And yeah, this story usually takes like half an hour, and I'm like discovering it as I go, and I'm trying to condense it into a few minutes, and it's not unfolding properly. So I'd been in this funny place where like I'd been so isolated when I was a kid, and like I put art on such a high pedestal that I think the reason I didn't want to make just comic books is that I really believed in high art. And when I was a kid and not fitting in Jewish schools, my best friends were like Matisse and Picasso and Proust and Virginia Woolf, these like really highbrow abstract writers and painters. And I wanted to enter this world of high art because I thought that's where my people were. And then I had this block where I couldn't make the high art. I couldn't feel like I was connecting with it. So anyway, when I opened the I guess, I'm so sorry, the end of the story is that I did actually connect to the Gunzel brief, and I realized that that this, my feelings of outsiderness and longing to connect were these things that these Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe had also felt leaving their own tiny communities. And I think I better answer some questions. I have stage fright. I'm sorry.
So maybe I can ask the first question. Did a good job putting this back. Okay. So my first question would be: there were, you know, thousands of these letters written over the years. Thousands. Imagine, it was like, it was really the Dear Abby, where people poured out their hearts about every possible thing. So how did you make your selection of these letters and responses that are in here, and that really I find so moving and so touching, and really, are amazing illustrations of the human condition, the human dilemma, and especially all the things you were just trying to express of arriving in a new place and being an outsider in so many ways and not knowing where to turn, really not knowing where to turn for help. So how did you make your selection of these stories?
When I got this Six Points Fellowship, which was the Jewish grant to make the comic, I had fallen in love with this book of translations of the Gunzel brief, which was published in around 1970 by Isaac Metzger. It's called 60 Years, a Gunzel brief, 60 Years of Letters from the Lower East Side to the Jewish Daily Forward, and I highly recommend it, and I love them so much. But the grant gave me all this money that I was supposed to spend on my project, so I decided that all the letters in my book should be letters that hadn't been translated yet. So It was a lovely process. I took like a couple months of Yiddish classes, and I learned enough Yiddish. I think you can tell if you read my stories, like you can see how much Yiddish I speak. It's like nothing, but I have this like, I kind of feel like I understand the texture of it, but totally misunderstand everything that's really going on. So there are two places in New York City where you can find old microfilm of Yiddish, and I didn't go to YIVO, which is one. I went into the Dorot wing of the New York Public Library, and it's just this magical, beautiful room, and I asked the probably Yiddish-speaking librarian if I could have microfilm from the first year of the Gunzel brief, 1906, and I spoke enough Yiddish that I could pick out the Gunzel brief from the other articles, and I could just kind of see which ones were about very topical political issues, and I didn't use those because I probably should have. I've become more interested in politics since then, but back then I was much more interested in romance, and I printed them out, and they were just like romantically, the screen was romantically flickery, and the Yiddish was romantically blurry, and I sent them to this very nice translator named Jordan Kutzik, and he could only read 10 or 11 of the ones I printed out, and he translated those. And it was my first, aside from that opus, I'm so sorry, I couldn't explain to you in detail, it was the first comic book I worked on, and I had no idea where to start or how to make a good comic, so I just kind of like spread all these things out and also left the book open and just started like many different stories, and the ones that grabbed me are the ones that made it into the book, and I didn't realize until I was finished that they kind of all had this romantic theme and this kind of simple theme of loss. And I think all the Gunzel brief letters probably did have that theme.
So does this book represent all of the ones that were translated, or some of the ones?
Some.
Some.
Yeah, it's. I think it's six
from the microfilm and five from Isaac Metzger's book.
The ones from microfilm
were very. I think Isaac Metzger chose the ones that were the best written. A lot of the ones from microfilm were really like scattered, like the one about the watch. I don't think you'd understand what it was about if you hadn't read synopses of it. It was just like these sentence fragments.
By the way, I just want to say how much I appreciate your candidness. Right? Thank you. I think we all do. Yes. Any other questions from the audience? Or any? Yes. Carolyn.
What I really like about this project is the blending of vernacular forms. They're using sort of comic realm art and sort of combining that with Yiddish, which is a total vernacular form. So can you talk about that? You mentioned your attraction to high art, but this does not seem like that to me,
yeah.
In a good way.
Yeah.
So is there something unique about the sort of comic graphic novel form that you thought would be most fit to represent the vernacular of the world that is Yiddish? I mean, I would love actually to see some of those fragments. I think that actually would be really interesting. So anyways, just speak a little bit of them.
I don't think I actually started to like comics until after I finished this project. Like, I think the reason I messed up so badly is that there's like so much I wanted to say and I couldn't figure out which tiny part is the most important. But this, I did draw each of the stories in slightly different styles, and on the surface it looks like I was trying to channel the different letter writer sensibilities, but I think that's really more of a lucky mistake. The real thing that I was doing was trying to find my own style, because I hadn't done this before. And the people I was copying were Maurice Sendak a lot, Chagall a whole lot. I think he's lowbrow in a wonderful way. Art Crumb, who I always have loved. This one, I was looking at a lot of Kate Colwitz prints. This is this like very, I think this is the saddest story in the book. And I drew it in this kind of German expressionist style because it's just all about guilt. And I drew a lot of stars and a lot of like tears. I think what I love about A Bintel Brief, and I think what I've been mistaking for a love of highbrowness when I was younger is just like that the emotions are like spilling out of it. And I felt like when I was younger, I felt like the emotions were spilling out of me. And so I related a lot to poetry, but these letters have that to the highest extent also. And so I just tried to draw like the most simple and most emotional symbols that I could, stars and tears and birds.
The foreword was part of my childhood. My grandfather, who was born in Poland and in World War I, was pulled into the Russian army and spent 3 years in a German POW camp. It was a different Germany in World War I. But he read the forewords every day, cover to cover. He understood English, he read the New York Post, and he read the Morning Sun and Telegram, I think, in the evening papers. So he read, but he never spoke English. He spoke to me in Yiddish. So when it was the secret language, I learned Yiddish, verbal Yiddish. And because I was going to Hebrew school, I knew the Hebrew letters, so I would read the forewords a few times a week, sounding out the letters and realizing what the word was and then understanding the context. But he never mentioned the Bintel Brief to me. I have a pretty good recollection of my few conversations with my grandfather, mainly about the war. I asked him to tell me war stories, and they were amazing. But he never volunteered stuff. He was like you, a very shy person, and understood English, but was too shy to attempt to speak it. He was also the first person to vote every election day. He was the first person at the election booth. Anyway, it's an amazing thing. But the fact that he never discussed the Bindel brief, which was clearly, he read the newspaper cover to cover, was that it was like a secret pleasure, a secret treasure thing.
Yeah.
And he couldn't share it because he would be embarrassed as a man to talk about it.
I wonder if you, I bet he liked it. You think
no,
so?
I'm sure.
A lot of, Abraham Kahan got a lot of criticism from like the other, the real socialists for doing this like gross, sexy thing. There was, this comes from nowhere, but I just wanted to tell you about the Gallery of Missing Husbands, which is, it was a spin-off of a Bindel brief. There were so many, it was like a photograph, it was photographic with a little bit of text, and there were so many Bindel brief letters being written by women whose husbands had abandoned them that it became this whole new feature. And it was this thing that happens a lot in those days. I think most of the letters were from women whose husbands had left Eastern Europe and gone to America to get a job and then promised to bring them over with their kids later. And the husbands would be so dazzled by America that they would just run off. And these women would write these like heartbreaking letters with photographs. And then the forwards readers would keep an eye out and often find the men and bring them back and make them pay. And I think I did a bunch of etchings without words, just of men's faces based on some of these photographs, and that's kind of that's in the middle of the book, and I think the book revolves around it also. It's nice when you realize that, it's nice when you make your history revolve around your present. I feel like my present is very much about running after boyfriends who don't like me very much, and this book is more of an autobiographical story of that.
So this is some of those etchings, yeah? So we have Mendel on one side and Shmuel on the other.
Uncle Shmuel.
Where's Shmuel? And they're amazing. They're wonderful drawings.
I think
Fishka and Moshe are here as well. They may have died as well. That also could have happened. They could have died.
Yeah.
No trace.
They just disappeared.
Yes.
Hi. I would guess, like you said, that maybe they fell in love with the glamour of being in the new country. But I mean, wasn't the more likely story that they were probably as impoverished as many other people, and they were working hard, and they never had enough money, and they didn't know maybe how to.
Say
that to the family that was waiting for them.
Yes.
Isn't that as likely?
Yes.
We don't know.
Right.
Nicole.
Since, in a very ironic way, what ended up catching your interest was something of a Jewish nature, what's your opinion now about your own Jewish identity? It seems, from the first part of your talk, it seemed as if there was your view of the small little conservative synagogues and then retreat into art, but now it seems as if what ended up happening, especially in Bindel brief, it's that through the Jewish tradition or the Jewish identity that you have that your art kind of expression. So what's your feeling about it now, and do you feel as if there's any future uses that you might be able to find for future works?
I think my drawing comes from one thing, but I think my need to tell stories really comes from a Jewish place. I don't really know what it is. I know that my parents were always, we went to synagogue out once a week, and like we did Friday night, and I feel like the stories just entered me, and I know that whatever art I make is coming from a Jewish place. Or at least an ancient place, and I'm accessing the ancients through the Jewish. The Jewish thing is, I think what I've learned from while I was making this project is that I'm not alone. I had the 6 Points Fellowship to make the project, which was 9 Jewish artists. And I was expecting to feel alienated in the fellowship. I was expecting everyone to be kind of like youth group kids or something, like very simple and boisterous. But nobody was, like, the different artists were of different levels of
of observance, but everyone was kind of had a complicated story, and no one's parents were completely proud of them in the Jewish departments. Like, most of us didn't, even the most religious of us didn't go to synagogue, and our art was also like kind of walking the line. I think all of us would have said that our art was coming from a Jewish place, but not necessarily about Jewish subjects. And since then I've made, like, my friends who I've made since then who are Jewish, like, seem to all have the same story. So I think there's strength in numbers, and I think we all care, and I think we'll figure it out together, like, what it means to be Jewish and without having to do things that we don't believe in. And I also think a lot of comics artists are coming from the same place too. Like, the way I said that I hated comics, but I'm gonna pretend to be a comics artist because that's the way I'm gonna be able to draw. I've realized that it's kind of a women's issue in a certain way. Like, a lot of women who do comics, and a few less, but still a lot of men, weren't raised with comics, because in this country, comics are for, like, boys, and especially nerdy boys. And we're allowed to be comics artists and take them back from the superheroes and make them what we want to make them, and we don't have to draw narratives in boxes about action. So look forward to a future of different Jews and different comics.
Yeah, I remember from my childhood vaguely a Yiddish song called "A Brivel in the Mama." Do you have any information about it?
Yes, it's a very famous song, "Brivel in the Mama," and it's a very heart-wrenching song of someone who's writing home to mother, and we haven't seen in a long time. And it's readily available. You can find it on a lot of recordings.
Right.
Yeah. It's a very lovely, poignant song. Any Yiddish song about mamas is
exactly.
Yes, grab you by the heartstrings in some fashion, usually with guilt. Any other questions? Yes.
My experience was counter to the one this gentleman spoke about. My dad was an immigrant from the Ukraine, and he had a candy store and made a minimal living, could speak English and read English, but he didn't pour it every day, so I knew it was in the house. And he read the Middle Brief regularly, and my experience on that was every once in a while he would call me over and he said, "Jackie, I want to read something to you, a Bindel brief." And almost always, the thing he had a lot of passion and compassion in looking at these stories. They were heartfelt in him. That's why he wanted to speak with me about them and convey them. But so many of them had to do with an older immigrant person and a Americanized child and the culture conflict that was taking place. So many of them were like, look, the father did so much for this boy and sent him to Hebrew school and he wants to marry a shiksa.
Yes.
And that came up over and over again. And I was Americanized,
Is there a question you'd like to ask?
I'm really wanting more to tell you this.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, the Bindel brief, as even by this little sampling, covers such a spectrum of human experience. That's a wonderful one that you mentioned about the immigrant, the clash. I don't know if that's in there. No, it's kind of there in the story with the father a little bit.
That was the kind of one of the really tragic things about A Bintel Brief is that it started out as this like intense life or death thing with like people writing like, I'm starving and I don't know what to do. Can someone adopt my children? And like, just like these intense things. And it, as the years passed, it became this more like nostalgic, sad thing of like, my children don't respect me and don't speak my language and don't respect my traditions. And that's partly, that's the tragedy of the forward, kind of. The forward was this like amazing force for helping people assimilate, and it helped them so well that Yiddish became obsolete. And I made a conscious effort only to take letters from the very early Bintel Brief that weren't about that. They were more like the joyous, like tragic thing, not the nostalgic, mild melancholy. But there's this thread running between the stories. I made this I don't even know what to call it. I call it the in-between story, where there's a few pages of narrative connecting all the stories together, and that narrative is about missing, not really knowing what to do with this missing the old, but knowing that nostalgia isn't really something you can act upon. And I think that was the thread running through Abraham Kahan's life. He was all about moving forward and helping people escape Eastern Europe and leave the Yiddish language behind even. But he was also a novelist and a fiction writer, and all of his stories and all of his novels are just like heavily nostalgic about these Dickensian tragic heroes who work really, really hard to become American and then just like are so sad and empty afterwards and have lost their culture. So in my in-between narrative, it involves a character based on me and a character based on Abraham Kahan, who's a ghost who comes out of this old notebook full of Bintel Brief letters that is the only old thing my grandmother owned. And it's kind of a reversal where you expect Abraham Kahan to be angry at me for not knowing about Yiddish culture, but it's actually, he jumps out of this notebook and he gets so excited about modern day New York and he just wants to become this techie, and I'm like wrenching these stories out of him. And I think that's the nostalgia really remains. I think like third and fourth generation immigrants are much better able to appreciate their culture than first or second generation immigrants who just want to throw it away.
What drew me to this lecture, of course, I see that I have some commonality with other people, is what you hear from your parents. And my mother used to say, Papier and a Kinder. What happened was the young generation immigrated to United States and or to Israel, and the old parents were left there to get letters from their children. And I guess my mom felt this emptiness when I left, and I became a papier and a kinder also. And they probably needed some physical relationship with their children, somebody to go to the market, somebody to buy medicine, somebody to overlook them, and we were no longer there. So I assumed somehow that the letters communicated about those children that had left. And I have another reason that I came, because I thought that your interest denotes a romantic notion. And I would like so much to see the young generation aware to a romantic relationship. People have become so jaded and so over-materialistic that nobody thinks in terms of sentiment. So this is why I came. I'm sorry I couldn't understand you, but it was, what I did get was very interesting.
I don't know if you're gonna understand what I'm saying, but this story is about the guilt of this young man who came to America and left his family behind in Poland, I think, and he's just writing about what on earth he should do with his father, who's this like broken man who's been through all these big crimes, and he's very religious, and he would never be able to survive in America. He just belongs in Poland, and the young man's sisters want to come join him in America, but they don't want to leave the father behind just kind of to wither away. So there's no answer to that question. The answer is just contact us privately. And so the reader is left to wonder what on earth the man was going to do.
Yeah, I actually thought that was amazingly powerful, that this was such a dilemma. There was even this wise newspaper couldn't respond publicly to this question about what to do about the father. And you know, it said contact us privately. That was very, very wonderful that you included that, actually.
Do you know why they would have said that?
Maybe they said something that would have offended people who had, you know, very similar dilemmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kept hoping the newspaper was going to send some money or something.
Maybe that happened.
Yeah.
That bears a little research, right? Yes, someone else who hasn't asked a question, and then otherwise, yes.
I just wanted to say, first of all, that when I was a kid, comic books were very popular, and they were written for boys and girls. We used to take them to camp and read them under the blanket. So obviously, the way technology has changed, and, you know, so hopefully you'll bring back that art, because we loved it as young people. And then I wondered, you said your parents told you about the Binder Brief. Were your grandparents aware
of
either side of your family?
My grandparents, I don't think either set of grandparents read the foreword. I think they were a little bit too religious, and they weren't socialists. They read, I wish I knew what newspaper they read. I know they read something in Yiddish, but my copy of Isaac Metzger's Bintel Brief Letter.
Maybe they'll talk.
Not the Tug.
The Tug
was too intellectual.
The Tug merged with the Morning Journal.
Yeah.
What was Lewis Miller's?
Their Tug, the Day,
yeah.
Merged with another paper. One was modern, and one was more intellectual. Isaac Bashevis Singer published in the Morning Journal. Anyway, those two papers combined, I think, in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe
later.
Maybe
later.
So,
yes.
Well, sorry, you had
your hand up first. Years ago, I don't know whether it was the Museum of the City of New York or
the Jewish Museum,
they had articles that were sent in to the newspapers, to the forwards many years ago. Some of them we would consider humorous today, but at that time they were considered serious. One of the letters was from a mother who was really upset because her daughter was going into a mixed marriage. The mixed marriage was that she was an Ashkenazi and the fiance was a Hasidim. So she was really upset and wanted to know what to do about this marriage.
Today that would be...
I obviously don't know why... the editor didn't include the response, but when I read that, I thought it was because, you know, Kahana was taking a tremendous amount of heat, or some significant heat, for his very, very strong secularist, complete Americanization, forget the ways of the old world, particularly in terms of religion. And I think there was a time that he was trying to keep that a little bit away from the public. When I read that, that's what I thought he wanted to tell the kids. You gotta take grandpa, or take your father, bring him here, let him be an American Jew.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, the Statue of Liberty, I love the drawing of it. It's such an ambiguous, you know, whether you watch films or whatever, how you treat it. I was wondering how you viewed the Statue of Liberty growing up.
Trying to remember. I know we had a pencil sharpener of her, and I loved that. I, That shade of green, I think, is my mom's favorite color, although she's never told me so explicitly. She wears a lot of maybe jade-ish jewelry, or did back then, and our house growing up, which she designed, had a lot of green copper on it, so that I love the color of it. I'm gonna think about this. May I respond to that a little bit? Because it's one of my earliest memories when I was 3 and a half and we came from Europe. It was my father and I. My mother was already in America. And the boat came in. It was a merchant marine vessel bringing some last refugees way after the war, long after. And it was, in the middle of the night or something, but everyone went up on deck because we were about to see the Statue of Liberty. And everyone, even as a child, I understood the significance of this, seeing this extraordinary statue. So it has real momentum and impact. And I think this drawing, kind of conveys that power that viewing the statue, especially for the first time, has for anyone. Yeah. And there's one other question here, and then I have one last question for you, and then I think we need to stop. We need questions because we're running out of time, I think, right? I don't know where.
Somebody new right here.
Yeah. So let's. If we have a question.
No
question. Comment. We have lots of comments. Okay, so I have a question, and then if we have time, we do have time?
Yes.
Okay, I'll ask a question, and then we'll get to more comments. Is that okay? Question, you mentioned joyous tragedy, right? Is that, or tragic joy? How did you put it? Tragic joy, or joyous tragedy, wasn't that something you said? Tragic. Joy.
Oh, tragic joy. Oh, yeah. That was just...
Joyous tragic.
Being
this
scared, yeah.
Joyous tragic, okay. I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit on that how it affected this, what you mean by that. Because I think it's quintessentially Jewish, this idea of like walking that edge between joy and tragedy, that happens a lot, and I have many examples of that related to being Jewish in my life, but...
Yeah, I think I meant just these, immediate sadness and just... there's something so joyous about immediate feelings. Like, when I read a Shakespearean tragedy in which people die, the only feeling I bring away from that is, I'm so happy to be alive. I'm, it's so... I just love immediateness, and I'm talking about immediateness, and I feel like the later Bintel Brief letters were not immediate. I feel like there were so many layers, and I hope that I grow to appreciate layers as I grow older. I feel like the thing that draws me to art is always an immediate thing, and I tend to like immediate art, and I think the thing I'm afraid of in real life is that it's very layered and I escape into art, which is much simpler.
Okay, comments?
I was just reminded when I was listening to all this that the great tragedy of which I know that you are trying to work to preserve. I know that you're trying to preserve Yiddish, but how disappointing it is when parents feel that they are the last generation that will have facility with Yiddish, because their children will no longer have grown up in a house where Yiddish is spoken so much of the time, I know that in my family, my sister and I speak to each other still in Yiddish, but we're together just because we enjoy it. But our children, it's like it really is a foreign language for them. So anyway, no one mentioned Al Jolson and my Yiddish mama.
which I think points out, when you hear that, the recording of that, points out the difficulty in really translating the sentimental value in the two languages. It really is such a pale shadow of the Yiddish version of My Yiddish Mama, but when you translate it into English, it does not have the oomph.
Just in response very quickly about that, do you want to respond to that? Anyone today who writes in Yiddish, teaches Yiddish, who isn't involved in a religious world, is really kind of swimming against the current. There's no question about that. But every day, I'm astonished by the level of creativity and inspiration that comes out of Yiddish culture. And this is a wonderful example right here. And this project led this young woman to studying some Yiddish. Maybe it will lead you to study more Yiddish, I hope so. And then you can translate more letters or whatever it is you need to do. Maybe this will lead other young people who will have encountered this whole idea for the first time to explore the whole world of Yiddish culture, whether in the original or in translation, it doesn't matter. There's a whole universe to be explored, and that's kind of what gives me some hope and faith. And then I have 11 students studying Yiddish this quarter, many of them who are here today, so that's terrific right there. Yeah. Henry. I love this book exists.
Yeah. As a person who came from a home where the Freiheit was read, I'd like to.
That's the left. In case you don't know.
I'd like to bring in a perspective that we have tiptoed around. I think historians agree that there are four major causes or problems that arose.
Is everyone here?
Yes.
Let him speak in the
microphone. I think historians agree that there are four major developments that led to the state of Yiddish today. One obvious one is, of course, the Holocaust. The second is Abe Kahn, who, with the Oreitnikus, people who were in a movement to make America all right and cast off Yiddish and their cultural roots, deny their Yiddish heritage or legacy. I think it's important for that to be brought in. The other two, just so that we complete the four, is, of course, in 1948, the establishment of the State of Israel, which led to Hebrew only for a disastrous effect, and a final one, the fourth, what happened in the Soviet Union. So those four have to be looked at. And Abe Kahn is the one who is really responsible for what happened in the United States, where Yiddish culture was, or could have had a potential of thriving, and ended up in a disastrous situation.
Thank you for the comment. I'm not sure if you know that much about that issue. I don't know if we can put the entire blame on Abe Kahn for the loss of Yiddish in America. There are so many reasons, and I think this merits a PhD thesis if anyone's thinking about it.
How about 95%?
But one of the great ironies, of course, and you might be aware of this, is that that the Fovelt, because he was trying to help people assimilate, used a lot of Yinglishisms instead of pure Yiddish in the writing. And that was a deliberate choice, and it wound up watering down people's grasp and, you know, retention of Yiddish over the years. That did happen, yes. But on the other hand, it is the longest existing Yiddish newspaper in the world. Okay, it's over 100 years old, and it's still being published, and it has an amazing presence on the web, and with a wonderful audio resource, and you can read most articles with English translations. Anybody can read online, and if you have any knowledge of Yiddish whatsoever, and be helped along the way. And so that's also his legacy. Right? So for the next generation, perhaps, we'll be making use of this resource that he began. So, ha! I can only say this because we're good friends.
Not his legacy.
One last minute.
Someone else, yes.
To me, when Liana is talking about immediacy and joy and tragedy, I feel that at the beginning, when the Bintel Brief first began, it was more basic. And then later on, it seemed perhaps to be more superficial.
I think it was life or death, and then it was more like these strange emotions of like family and all this stuff. It was more, yeah, the beginning seemed, I don't know, the beginning seemed more like your life after you've made this crazy, huge change, and the rest seemed more like how you relate to your family after you've been having like the same saga going on very slowly and gently for 30 years or something, very, very layered.
Yeah, and, but weren't some of them, there were, like Dear Abby, there were romantic questions, right? Some fellow loves me at work, but I don't know if I'm that crazy about him. But on the other hand, I have no prospects. What should I do? and some things about problems in the workplace. There were a lot of letters related to that. People who had problems with their bosses, whether it was women or men, you know, having issues, and they wrote letters to the Falwells. I don't know if in reading them, I mean, did you find yourself identifying, aside from the sense of being an outsider in some cases in these early letters, as you point out, but were there other issues that you felt you could identify with even today?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to say more about that? What is the in this book, is there a one particular letter that you identify with more strongly than others?
Yeah, I think the one I identify with a bunch. I think the successful letters in the book are the ones I identified with a lot, and some of the letters not so much, but one of the ones I identified with a lot is the last letter of this. It was part of a pamphlet of this young woman whose husband died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, and he saved her life, and then he died, and she doesn't know whether to go on, and she's kind of caught between this like immediate intense tragedy of like that's just overwhelming her world and being pulled back towards normal life 4 years after this tragedy happened. And she's asking whether the tragedy is more real or whether real mundane life is more real. And the editor's answer is, let the tragedy go and move forward. And you don't have to be dramatic forever. You can move on and be just a normal person now and find another boyfriend.
Yeah, that was very incredibly moving. I don't know, did anyone have a chance to read that one? It's really incredible, yeah, and could pertain to anyone.
That's online.
Yeah. Yes, a question. Do we have a question? Yes. Okay, last question. And then I think we have to stop. Yeah, we have to stop. Sorry. Yes. Question. Yes.
Oh, I was just going to respond to the gentleman here. I'm not at all an expert on Eitan, but I, reading what I've read about him, he was writing for people who had emigrated here, mostly with negative things in their old country. They wanted to be part of this country. They wanted to learn English. He was still giving them a Yiddish newspaper. They could still speak Yiddish, have a Yiddish background. But I'm sure it was very important to them to assimilate to this new world, which was, the Statue of Liberty and wonderful. And so it was, I imagine, very important to know for them to want to learn English. And he was able to help them while he was still giving them a Yiddish newspaper.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.